We have two last requests from one scientist and an SCS person. Yeah, okay, but we're going to accept them. It was a democratic procedure. After you,
but yes, that's fine. So Science for Policy. So one of the very first books I wrote was actually introduced the term regulatory science into American policy discourse, and it was about the fact that science that's done explicitly for policy purposes often is different in its contextual underpinnings. You mentioned one of those things, that the results don't get published in peer-reviewed articles. Often the results end with a decision rather than being productive grounds for building new knowledge and so forth. So very definitely one has to think about how knowledge that is being developed for the specific purpose of a set of decisions being taken and will not have wider circulation in the world can still be robust knowledge. I think that's a genuine challenge and a problem, again, of the design of things like advisory committees. Some of the time it's assumed that that knowledge doesn't have to have a life of its own, but of course you can ensure that people actually recursively come back to the same kind of decision to look at it again. So America, America still thinks it's a very young society and therefore doesn't have to remember its childhood and adolescence, and no history is needed because there is no history. I was telling Piero over lunch that Harvard University, in its latest curricular revision, has done away with the blanket requirement that all undergraduates must have a course in history. The new version is simply that one of the required courses must have historical content, which is not the same as actually requiring that history is a requirement. So it's not surprising that in American regulation, there's been very little attention given to collecting knowledge over time and actually trying to build up a kind of internal learning process and mechanism which can to some degree substitute for the absence of peer review. So you can collect experiential knowledge. I mean, if you say that GMOs are not going to escape and they keep escaping every 3 years, it could add up to something eventually. So far it hasn't, because each one is treated as a separate issue. And, you know, you pay off the people and you forget about them, and who knows anyway, it's very specialized. So, it doesn't come back to produce a learning curve, as we call it, you know, which will have results. So I think that there are respects in which science done for public policy is different, tends to be more interdisciplinary, tends to be in areas where no single person has the expertise, tends to be produced out of group contexts, tends not to have obvious prefixed criteria of legitimacy or validation procedures. I think you can compensate for some of these things, but we usually have not, because people don't even recognize the problem to start with. There is the opposite problem of thinking that because policy should be founded on sound science, give me a policy, any policy, and I'll find you the science for it. And so we're going a little bit in that direction with something called sustainability science, which I think is a terrible development, because it suggests that, above all, a form of life which recognizes in its very definition that it's very complex. Human beings have to live with nature and not against it in some sense. To say we can scientize that way of thinking and take out the ethics and take out the politics and take out the power, but just make it into sustainability science, I think that's a move that actually reduces accountability. So we have to also ask, where are places where, you know, prematurely and almost in intellectually irresponsible ways, science is being developed to undergird policy, when really what you should have is more ethics, more politics, more deliberation, and those kinds of things. On your points about the legal issues, those were more very interesting observations than questions. The German constitution also puts human dignity as the only constitutional provision in the basic law that is not negotiable and is said to be absolute. One problem with making those absolute provisions is that lawyers and judges have a way of trying to avoid that territory, so there isn't a great deal of jurisprudence that focuses specifically on the absoluteness of human dignity. So people tend to try to, you know, that's this pariah area that you don't go into. You try to develop your legal arguments somewhere else where you're kind of more familiar with the trade-offs and so on and so forth. The post-Seveso directive, I mean, of course, that's a very interesting parallel, which I will put next to my Payne versus Department of Energy or whatever it was, or Nuclear Regulatory Commission versus Payne judgment in my mental Rolodex. But you also made the interesting point that, of course, there are consequences to this. And I think, to me, my training in law has been invaluable, I mean, really absolutely essential in unlocking my thinking about imaginaries, because so much of the way that the law makes progress is by reconceiving society in different terms. That's how you think of a new legal form of action and how innovation occurs. And then, as you very rightly point out, there are consequences that happen from that. Now, technology or technologists often, as we pointed out in that report, have a narrative for those consequences. They call them unintended consequences. And so if they were unintended, then the planners don't have to bear any responsibility or blame for it, because only the good things were intended. The bad things are always unintended. So your comment reminded me that we need to be not Manichaean in our understanding of consequences and pretend that the bad is always on the unintended side and the good is always on the intended side, which perpetuates this master narrative of progress in interesting ways. And then lastly, your point about robotics, nanotech, and engineers' responsibility and so forth. The first thing I would want to know is how you were raised and educated in order to become such an eloquent spokesperson for a different kind of engineering consciousness and education yourself, because as you pointed out, most of your engineer colleagues don't actually want to listen to this sort of thing. So I'll tell you an anecdote. We at Harvard now have a new School of Engineering and Applied Science. For many years, ever since MIT was founded, Harvard didn't think it needed a school of engineering because MIT was the engineers and we were the intellectuals. So now it's been recognized that in order to have a sort of seamless web of transmission from, I mean, universities have become commercial centers, right? I mean, it's not the ideas that matter anymore, it's the returns that you get. So Harvard cannot capitalize on its brain power without having more engineering. That's now been recognized as axiomatic. So in the last couple of years, engineering, which used to be a division in arts and sciences, has now become a school. And soon, I predict in the next 5 years, we will have a self-standing Harvard School of Engineering and Applied Science paralleling MIT. So they're thinking of having a new undergraduate curriculum called Technology and Society. And recently I went to talk to the people who are planning this curriculum. And so they're wrestling over having a new course, just one semester, 3 hours a week, called Technology and Society. And they're having vigorous fights about whether it should be taught by an engineer or possibly team taught and what its content should be. And all the engineers are very nervous that it might become engineering light, you know, like beer is beer light, L-I-T-E. So this will become engineering light, and so it won't have any content. But they've already decided that the first year of this curriculum, 8 courses, 4 per semester, will be foundational classes. 7 of them will be in technical fields like math and statistics and physics and so forth, and 1 will be economics. And so when I was there, one of these, the youngest person in the committee said, if this is going to be technology and society, don't you think that one of the foundational courses should be on the society side? That economics is not by itself enough? And so then they had this big debate, but how can you have a foundational course without, unless they've already learned the technical stuff? And I said, well, let me imagine this with you. You know, you could, for instance, take you know, three seminal technologies of the 20th century, like, you know, cars, contraceptives, and computers. You know, I wanted to grab their minds with alliteration. And I said, under each, you could thematize it and talk about controversies, design, and power. So power was in my mind. So my eminent colleagues, whom I know somewhat, said, so what did you say the themes would be? Controversies, power, oh yes, and design. Now I understand why you said before that you didn't think Harvard had the expertise to teach these kinds of courses. These are not concepts that are taught in any of our existing traditional disciplines, are they? And I said, no, only in STS. And he said, I find that strangely liberating. Liberating. So, you know, this is, I mean, the problem with engineers is that on the one hand, they're natural STS analysts, because much more than pure scientists, you are constantly working up against the realities of life, which includes funding from DARPA. It includes producing things for the military battlefield. It includes understanding things like friction and energy and these concepts that are sort of important to making things run. But it also gives engineers an ultimate hubris that the designing imagination exists only in engineering and nowhere else. Because after all, to do it right, to make the machine that works, you've got to get all the pieces in order from the theoretical physics or chemistry or biology all the way through to the society. And the idea that somebody like me, say, could actually come and give them a new idea, it's very difficult to get that across. And, you know, so if you come and say, I mean, I can carry authority because I have the CV to prove it, but not many people can come and tell a group like that, which is, you know, they're some of the foremost people in computer science and, you know, other fields, to tell them, oh, you should have more ethics. I mean, they'll just blow it off the table. I mean, you know, you think we should have ethics? Well, we'll figure it out ourselves. I mean, you know, something like that. So these are big challenges, how to alter mindsets of entire disciplines that have material successes to show how great they are. You know, we humanists don't have very much. I mean, you know, what do we have? I mean, you know, Shakespeare lasted longer than phlogiston. I mean, you know... So let me leave it at that.
Well, in the case of Gianmarco, the answer was from Japanese engineers that they were going to build the ethical chip to put in robots.
Yeah, and it's true, you know. Implanted into people.
Yeah, and it's localized, you know. So do you want to end with a scientist or an STS person?
I thought you said you'd take both.
Yeah.
Well, how about a scientist to have the last word?